My ambition after that trip to the Highlands was simply to see if Tasmania could make a really good single malt whisky.
We don't expect everyone to like these wines, so yes, there's some risk.
Drink more sherry, because that's when you can really educate yourself on what happens in maturation.
The thing is with Australian natives, you put them in a gin, the aftertaste invariably is just bitter and unpalatable.
I think the Irish whisky landscape is going to be wildly different over the next 5 years.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits, and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today.
Most of us don't think twice about going to a brewery to buy a beer, but have you ever thought about buying into the business? This episode, it's podcast host versus podcast hosts, as I chat to Bryce Leskey and Alec Renahan from investing podcast Equity Mates about putting your money where your mouth is. Equity Mates has been educating Australians about investing in a jargon-free, informal style since 2017. 500 episodes later, they run a network of 9 money-related podcasts and will host FinFest, Australia's biggest investing festival, in Sydney this October. This interview was a chance to get Bryce and Alex's insights on some of the recent developments at ASX-listed companies like Treasury Wine Estates, Lark Distilling, Top Shelf International, Good Drinks and Mighty Craft, all of whom have previously featured on Drinks Adventures in one way or another. It's not all about the share market, though. Bryce and Alec had a lot to say about the psychology behind investing and whether equity crowdfunding is good for drinks companies or your bank balance. Australian producers are increasingly turning to equity crowdfunding to raise capital. Just in the last couple of months, there's been successful campaigns from Bridge Road Brewers, Akasha Brewing, Bakery Hill Distillery, and Republic of Fremantle Distilling. There's more opportunities than ever before for drinks enthusiasts like you and I to get some skin in the game. So, if you've ever wanted to learn the difference between an IPO and an IPA, here's your chance. Well, Bryce and Alec from Equity Mates, thanks so much for joining us on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Thanks for having us, James.
Thanks for having us, James. Bryce was telling me before he's been on plenty of adventures on the drink, but never on a drink adventure.
we'll get into some of those later on, perhaps. Now, look, I count 7 drinks companies on the ASX, from a supplier perspective: Treasury Wine Estates, Australian Vintage, Mighty Craft, Top Shelf International, Lark Distilling, Brew Limited, and Good Drinks Australia. And then also on the retail side, there's Endeavour Group, which owns Dan Murphy's and BWS. Are these companies that were already on your radar at Equity Mates prior to us having this chat?
Yeah, I mean, some of them have certainly been companies we've spoken about in detail. And I remember the challenges that Treasury Wines Estate had with China and Penfolds. So that's definitely been one that's spoken about in the community. Lark Distillery, definitely, for controversial reasons.
Although, James, I believe you had Jeff on your show at some point, so we should shout out any new listeners to go listen to that in the back catalogue.
But otherwise, some of these stocks are not ones that we often speak about, but there is a part of our community that certainly focuses on drinks and beverages.
Yeah,
and,
I think the overriding impression we get from the Australian beverage industry, and we don't need to be telling you or your listeners this, is outside of Treasury, they're all pretty small. And a lot of the big Australian brewers and distillers and stuff have got snapped up by those global giants. And the whole industry is pretty consolidated at this point. So you've got a lot of smaller players doing really interesting stuff, but they're all sort of in the double digits or triple digit million market cap. But that's not to say they're not great companies and they're making great alcohol. It's just they're not quite the Diageos or the LVMHs or the Heinekens of this world.
Well, I've been around, reporting on this industry for long enough to remember when Foster's was listed on the stock exchange, and also Lion Nathan just prior to that. Even Coca-Cola Amatil is another one that more recently got delisted or listed somewhere else as a result of a acquisition. But yeah, the interesting thing from my perspective is that there have been a few new ones that have kind of come up in recent years. Lark Distilling, Top Shelf International, and Mighty Craft are probably the three that are sort of the interesting ones that I've been following.
Yeah, I think Mighty Craft, that story and their better beer is an incredible story. You know, we've watched The Inspired Unemployed for so long, and the way that that beer has taken off is incredible. Bryce has had a dream for years to do Equity Grapes. And so if there's any winemakers out there that they want to, well, you know, we're not quite as big as Inspired Unemployed, and maybe wine won't do as well as beer, but, you know, I feel like that is going to be a real, I guess, strategy in the sort of next few years we see. We saw it in so many other industries, you know, makeup and beauty. They were really early with partnering with influencers and building those brands on the back of influencers' exposure. And Mighty Craft have been early in the alcohol game, doing it with The Inspired Unemployed, and it's so impressive what they've built. It's also a good beer.
Funnily enough, though, it's kind of not really what they set out to do, I don't think, Mighty Craft, when they launched. You know, it's sort of a bit more of a mainstream offering that's been so successful for them, when they were supposed to be more of an accelerator for these much smaller boutique companies.
It's funny how success like that changes your business plan.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, you know, like, it's really cool to see that really small brewer and really small distiller culture sort of start to make its way onto the ASX. And, you know, for years, we're in Sydney, and you can go out to sort of Newtown or the Inner West, and there's like, you know, small brewers that you can drink from, but you haven't really had a chance to invest in them. So it's kind of cool that now that opportunity is springing up on public markets for people like us that want to support the industry but also want to invest in the industry.
Now, when we look at that array of seven companies that I mentioned before, you know, which, when we look at Treasury Wine Estates being the biggest one, how big are they in an Australian investing context, and, you know, the other companies that are among that group? What's a small cap stock? We hear about, you know, small cap stocks, and how do you define one of those? And is that what all those other drinks companies would fall into?
Yes. So if we look at the biggest company on the ASX, I think it's CB, or potentially CBA, BHP. Well, CBA has a market cap of about 160 billion thereabouts, I would guess. Treasury Wine Estates has a market cap of 7.8 billion. So significantly smaller, still big, but significantly smaller than the larger players on the ASX.
Still in the ASX 200.
Yeah. And so then, in terms of defining, you know, what a small cap is, because a lot of those seven listed companies that you mentioned, James, definitely would fall in the smaller end of the market. It depends where you look around the world as to what a small cap is. In the US, where their market is a lot bigger than Australia, anywhere from sort of 200 or 300 million up to a billion or 2 billion market cap is considered a small cap. Whereas here in Australia, it's on a much smaller scale. So 50 million to sort of 500 million is a small cap. And so if we then take that and put it against those listed companies you spoke about, Aussie Vintage, 159 million, Mighty Craft, 57, Top Shelf, 74, Lark Distillery, 203 million, 8 million for Brew. They're probably a micro cap.
Yeah.
Lucky to even register. and Good Drinks is 90 million. So all in that sort of sweet spot of small caps, for sure.
And a small cap stock's something that you guys tend to watch or tend to be interested in from an investment perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think Australians in general love a small cap. Probably investors around the world love a small cap. The term's a bit loose, and because, you know, there's plenty of companies and that are at plenty different stages in their lifestyles, doing life cycles, doing plenty of different things that fit in that $50 million to $500 million value. But generally, the characteristics that define small caps are, you know, maybe not quite profitable yet, faster growth, maybe still trying to find product market fit, uncovered by traditional media or investment banks. And so a lot of people look at that profile and say, there's not a lot of attention paid to that part of the market by the media, by the big banks, the big investment banks. and they're in a growth phase, and so there's perhaps a little bit more opportunity if they find that product market fit and they get that hockey stick growth. So I think a lot of people who are willing to take more risk look at small caps to try and find more growth. You're not gonna get that same explosive growth in a, you know, a CBA, Commonwealth Bank, or a Woolworths or something like that. So there's heaps of interest in the Equity Mates community, in the investing community generally. But I got to say, some of these companies have definitely had more interest than others. I know a couple of years ago, before Good Drinks changed their name, when they were still Gage Road, we had a look at them, and there was a bit of excitement in the community about them. Obviously, Lark, because of the news stories. But even before then, I know there were a number of value managers talking about Lark because they were trading at less than the sale value of their all their alcohol. And so it would not, if they sold all their whiskey today, but if they held it until maturity and then sold it, the market value was less than that. So there were value investors really excited by that company. So there's been a bit of noise about some of these companies, but probably not as much as, definitely not as much as in your world, James, I'd say.
What do you mean by value investors? Because it's an interesting, I think it's a little bit debatable that you value a company based on its stocks that haven't been sold yet, when, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty about what the Australian whiskey market's going to look like when those stocks reach maturity. So there's no guarantee that you're going to be able to sell them and get a good price for them in a few years' time.
100%. That's the that's what separates good investors from great investors, I guess, being able to look into the future and make those predictions better than other people, or being able to find something that's undervalued. And, you know, it's the same if you're looking at Lark and trying to value what their whiskey is going to be worth in the future, or if you're looking at Fortescue Metal and trying to value what iron ore is going to be in the future. Either way, you're projecting forward what the value of the commodity is going to be, or the value of the asset's going to be, and then how much they're going to spend to sell it, and then what their profit's going to be on the back of that. So there were value investors that got really excited about Lark. I know when Jeff Bainbridge did step down or get fired and the share price tanked, a few of the big investment banks loaded up, or a few of the big fund managers loaded up because they
would have wished they waited a few weeks longer, I think, because the prices continued to go down since then.
And the 2022 prices everywhere just keep going down.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting company, I think. I haven't actually tried their whiskey. Is it good whiskey?
Oh, yeah, look, they make some cracking whiskies, absolutely.
I mean, that's the main thing.
Now, I have heard you talk about Treasury Wine Estates before, and you talked about the concept of a moat. What is an investment moat, and how would it apply to some of these companies, or would it apply to some of these companies that we're talking about?
So an investment moat, it's a concept that sort of explains how a company can build sustainable competitive advantage. And the reason that that's important is because then they have control of, or pricing power. It gives the business the ability to continue to raise prices and fend off competition. So there are five common ways a business can build a competitive advantage. The first is low-cost production. So relevant for the alcohol industry, if you can produce beers cheaper than your competitor, then you have the opportunity or the chance to build a bit of a moat there. The second is high switching costs. Not particularly relevant for alcohol industry, but that's where it's difficult and expensive for me to switch from one business to another.
The classic example was like telcos back in the day when they locked you into like a 24-month plan.
Yeah. But it's not very difficult. It's not expensive for me to switch from one beer to another. So no impact there. Network effects is another way, and that's where your business or your product increases in value as more and more people use it. Intangible assets, otherwise known as brand, you can build a strong competitive advantage by building a strong brand. And I think that's particularly relevant, for example, with Penfolds. Very strong brand and premium wine. And then
I think across the alcohol industry, like I think about someone like Great Northern and how they've built a brand around that beer, and it like conveys so much meaning in that brand.
Yeah, good one. And then efficient scale. Obviously, this is incredibly relevant in alcohol industry. The bigger you just look at the conglomerates around the world and how they manage to build and sustain competitive advantage just by eating up every single other small-time alcohol brand and then leveraging their efficiency and scale to create even more brand power. So, I think for some of the businesses listed on the ASX, definitely challenging to crack into and break, I guess, some of the competitive or the moats that exist with the larger alcohol companies, that's for sure.
And when you look at the wine industry, for example, you know, there's nearly, somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000 wineries in Australia and, you know, a lot of others that export over here as well. So, you know, it's a very competitive landscape.
Yeah. So Bryce and I in a previous life worked at the two major retailers. I worked at Coles and Bryce worked at Woolies. And I just remember being shocked when we had this presentation from someone in the Coles liquor team, and I learned how many of the wines were like Coles home brand wines, essentially. It was a real shock to me. You know, different brand and different labels, but all coming from the two majors.
For sure. And look, some of the businesses that I've mentioned, they're pretty new and, you know, still making losses. When you look at businesses that are in that position, in those sorts of positions, what are the financial fundamentals that you look at to assess how they're actually progressing?
So I think it depends on the size of the business in some ways. Some of those smaller businesses that are still in that growth stage, you might look at slightly different to some of the bigger ones, the treasuries or even the conglomerates. So for a smaller company that's really, you're really focused on the growth story there. So you're looking at things like, are they growing their revenue? Are they taking market share from their competitors? Are they landing in more and more retail outlets? Are they expanding overseas? Are they landing in more and more countries? And you might look at things like gross margin and how that's moving as they scale. So that's some of the metrics you'd look at to see, is the company growing? How quickly are they growing? And at what point will they reach profitability? But then you look at a larger company and, you know, you expect them to be profitable and you don't expect them to grow as quickly. But then you might be looking at things, well, you're looking at profit and you're looking at profit growth, but you're also looking at like how they're investing and how they're managing their portfolio of brands. So what's their mergers and acquisitions strategy? What are they divesting? What alcohols are they sort of moving into? You know, like gin had a massive moment in the mid-2010s and was just killing it. So you'd want to see your big conglomerates moving to where the puck is going. Things like return on equity, return on invested capital are some metrics that you might look at there. But for me, and James, you might completely disagree with me, but when I think about the alcohol industry and I think about some of these smaller players, I just really think that the end game for a lot of them, and as investors, how a lot of investors make money at the end of the day, is in an acquisition scenario that a $200 million brewer or distiller gets acquired by a $200 billion player. And so for me, then it's things like, who are the natural acquirers? How do they complement their portfolio? Are they in a part of the alcohol industry that makes sense? And, you know, are they taking market share from a competitor that may decide to buy them rather than compete with them? So I think, you know, those are some of the metrics you look for, but then it also very much depends on the industry you're playing in as an investor, because there's always industry-specific stuff.
We talked a little bit about Good Drinks just before. Now, they went through a share consolidation in November last year. What does that mean, and is that something that you see commonly?
It's not actually a common occurrence, as common as a stock split, but just to go back to the start of your question, what is a share consolidation? It's really where a company, it's a corporate action where they reduce the number of shares on offer through the company or that's on the market.
It's something that we only see, though, with you know, companies that have been trading at a very, very low share price, though, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I make perhaps a controversial statement? I don't think it means anything. Like, what matters is the percentage of the company that you own as an investor or as a founder, and all. It's all to do with investor psychology. So, you know, Good Drinks or Gage Road were trading, like a couple of cents a share? There's a certain psychological effect about a share price that low, and so they consolidated their shares. So let's say it was 10 to 1. For every 10 shares you owned, you ended up with one share. So if you owned 100 shares, you end up with 10. Your ownership percentage of the company doesn't actually change. All it's intended to do is push the stock price higher because there's less shares on issue. And so psychologically, people look at that and they're not turned off by it trading at like a cent or two. The opposite is the recent stock splits we've seen from like the major tech companies. Again, it's about psychology. So Amazon and Tesla were two recent examples. They were in the thousands of dollars. But as a shareholder, you owned the same percentage of the company. It was just in a different number of shares.
Now, another one that I've noticed in recent weeks is, we mentioned them before, Brew Limited, which are, you know, the penny dreadful of all penny dreadful stocks. Their shares were suspended from official quotation on May 11, and they've been suspended ever since. What does that actually mean? And are you guys aware of any precedent for a company to have its shares suspended for that amount of time?
Well, without knowing why it was suspended, there are a couple of reasons that stocks are suspended on the exchange, and it's usually to do with a market announcement. They might be in talks about acquisition or mergers. So it's when there's sort of price-sensitive announcements that they need to pause the trading of the company.
I've just looked up the ASX announcement. It says it's in relation to a restructure of the company. So it feels like maybe it's going out of business. I don't know. And this is me. Honestly, James, I'm going to be honest. Before we started speaking, I hadn't even heard of Brew. So I am not an informed commentator here, but that's maybe the impression I get. But yeah, well, I guess wait and see. It's not uncommon though. Companies delist or go in trading halts all the time. Normally the trading halts don't last too long. Normally it's, you know, they'll halt and then they'll have a big announcement. They're getting acquired or they are acquiring someone or, you know, the CEO is resigning or whatever. But then they'll start trading again. But yeah, you're right. It's been over a month. So
normally it's like 24 hours or 48 hours before the actual announcement comes. So yeah, it seems weird to me.
My view is the longer the halt, the badder the news.
Yeah, I think that's...
In all honesty.
I think that's pretty fair, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, there was a company called iSignThis that I remember was halted due to ASIC investigation and whatnot, and it obviously didn't turn out very well and then ended up not trading.
I can't say I've ever heard of them, though. So if you are a Brew shareholder, do not take what we're saying as any indication.
Now, we touched on Lark earlier on, but when you look at the market reaction to Jeff Bainbridge stepping down, you know, was that sort of a rational response, would you say? Or I suppose I shouldn't be looking to markets for a rational response anyway, but what did you think about the way the market reacted?
Yeah, I think if you're looking for rationality, don't look at the share market. but that's the opportunity as investors. If markets were perfectly rational, then you would never have those wild price fluctuations where opportunity sticks its head up. But look, in small caps, in small companies, management really matters because, you know, the company, it's not profitable maybe, or it's, you know, still trying to figure out its market, or it's trying to grow really aggressively and expand into new markets. It's just trying to get its name out there. Whatever it is, like the management is so critical there. In some ways, investing in small caps has similar hallmarks to investing in startups. You're a lot of the time investing in the people and the idea, whereas in the larger end of town, when the business is really established, you know, a Coles or a Woolies or whatever, the management matters, but it matters less because the business is so strong at that point. So yeah, when a CEO or a founder, I know Jeff wasn't the founder in this case, but you see it especially with founder CEOs, if they get fired or step down, the market generally hates that and gets a bit of a panic.
Now, one thing we've really seen a lot of in the drink space recently is equity crowdfunding. It's been incredibly popular as a way for some of these smaller companies to raise capital. Is that a trend that you guys have followed at Equity Mates?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly we've definitely seen the rise in popularity of crowdfunding.
There was a gin distiller that we were looking at, wasn't there?
Yeah, Westwinds.
Westwinds. Yeah, yeah. We didn't get in on it.
No, should have though.
Is it doing well?
Yeah, it went really well.
Damn.
Yeah. And so, yeah, and alcohol companies are generally one that you'll find or an opportunity you'll find there. I think from a, you know, from an accessibility point of view, these platforms are great for retail investors and, you know, you and I to get access to early stage companies. Of course, there's risks involved in that. It's very difficult to get your money out because of the liquidity of it. It's not like trading on a public stock exchange. And similarly for the brewers or those on the other end, you know, it's an expensive way of raising equity as well. So, definitely have seen it on our end, the rise in the crowdfunding model. And it's something that we have been watching here, but, nothing that we've sort of partaken in, that's for sure.
It makes a lot of sense where it's a really consumer facing business, because if you can crowdfund, your funding from a bunch of people who then become invested in your success, they become your brand ambassadors, they become your drinkers. You know, these are the kind of businesses where perhaps it makes more sense. It is an expensive way of raising money. Well, is it expensive?
Well, I mean, the administrative fees to go out and list on the platform and to, I guess, maintain the campaign and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, there's
a bit more of significant costs involved.
Bit more of a headache than just raising some money from
a VC.
Like, but I guess it's tough to raise from VCs.
Not as much of a headache as listing on the ASX, though.
No. And like, if people are listening and wanting to get in on the crowdfunding space, great. Like, it's a good opportunity. You just have to be very aware what the opportunity is, and it's likely that you're locking your money up for 5-7 years, you know, for a meaningful period of time, and you might not get that money back unless the company gets acquired or it lists on a stock exchange or something like that. It's not the same as investing in a stock on a stock market that you can sell the next day.
Now, speaking of equity, how about you guys? You've done a couple of capital raisings that I've read about with interest. Could there be an IPO on the horizon, or tell me what the future holds?
Oh, we always dream of an IPO, but
no, we are
very meta.
Yes,
we are having an IPO on the 15th of October.
Yes, we are. Our IPO, our initial party offering, is a major finance festival that we're throwing in Sydney on the 15th of October, and it's called FinFest. We are calling it our IPO, but yeah, that is our initial party offering. Finance festival like never before. So that is what's on the horizon from an IPO point of view for us. Come on down and join us. Tickets are on sale, equitymates.com/FinFest. We had to get that plug in.
And then maybe maybe after we do Equity Grapes, our wine range, we do IPO IPAs.
I like it. That's good.
That's not bad. But yeah, we're just continuing to grow our media business and engage and inspire retail investors to get active in the stock market. So whether or not it leads to an eventual IPO at some stage, yes, we have done some capital raising, but who knows?
A long way off.
Hopefully.
Yeah. But maybe just tell my listeners about the network of different shows that you've got, because it all sort of started with the one podcast, and it's really, I've been really impressed to watch and see the way it's grown from there.
Yeah, I mean, it started really with Bryce and I hanging out in a share house at uni, and he knew a little bit about investing and I didn't know much. And I feel like for so many Australians, they want to learn about investing and the stock market and all of that stuff, but you don't learn it. You don't learn it at school. For most of us, our parents grew up in a world where you buy your house, you pay off your mortgage, and that's how you build wealth in Australia. And so really the podcast was an excuse for us to learn, to get people to speak to us and to try and figure out this world of investing. And over the journey, what we've learned is that there's heaps of Australians that are like us, that didn't study finance, that don't work in the industry but want to learn and feel that like most financial media isn't that accessible. It's full of jargon and charts that make no sense, and people kind of get lost in it all. So that's what we have sort of, we've really just stumbled into it. We didn't start it with any grand plan, but we've got the main podcast that we started with, Equity Mates Investing Podcast. But we've also got seven others in the network. So whatever you want to learn, there's a podcast in the Equity Mates community for you. Go to equitymates.com and you can see them all. But yeah, I think for us, it's just about trying to make this big bad world of investing a little bit more accessible.
Fantastic, guys. Well, thanks very much for joining us on Drinks Adventures. Something a bit different for us. I've really enjoyed and I've learned a lot.
Thanks for having us, James.
Yeah, thanks, James. Appreciate it.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at by James Atkinson, like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.